Okay, today's topic is positive relationships. Positive relationships. And it's interesting because I was at a talk last Saturday night. I was giving a talk somewhere to a bunch of Israelis, a lot of Israelis in this area. And the question they asked me is, how is the Torah relevant to us today? You know, it's a book written 3,300 years ago. So how is it relevant? It should be updated. Where's the update? So I told them some interesting idea, and that is that society may have changed, but human nature has not. Let's think about that for a minute. Society has changed, as we think we're very advanced. Society is very advanced. We're driving our cars, and we're going to the moon, and we're in space travel, and all sorts of things. But human nature basically hasn't changed much. The same human behaviors that went on in those days, the same passions, the same emotional problems, the same mental issues that were going on in those days are here today. Human nature has not changed much. We find 20% of the Torah at least is about human interaction. There's a whole book of Genesis, of Bereshit, is really about human interaction. Most of it, the vast majority of it, negative. Now let's discuss that, because if we want to learn about positive relationships, we have to study what the Torah tells us is learn about all the negative relationships and find out how not to let your relationships develop in that way. Right? So that's what I want to do today. I want to examine if we say the Torah is a handbook for life and it really emphasizes failed relationships in the whole first book of Genesis right until the end of the book. Let's try and examine these relationships and see what happened, where did they go wrong? What happened to these relationships? Now, it's interesting because we have a three-pronged approach to relationships. And it's based on the Magen David. What is the Magen David? The Star of David. The symbol of Judaism is the Star of David. And the Star of David is made of two triangles, right? There's one triangle and then a second triangle superimposed on it. What does this triangle symbolize? So the answer is it symbolizes relationships. It symbolizes the Maharal of Prague. This is the Maharal of Prague, you know, the famous golem. He's the rabbi who made the golem. If you go to Prague today, you'll find a statue on the outside made by non-Jews, Gentiles. On the Prague, the golem of Prague. And there's a restaurant also called the golem of Prague. You know, the famous story of the golem, right? It was like a first android made, huh? What do you think? Wasn't a man. It was that's why it was stupid. It was like it was the origins of Frankenstein. That's where Frankenstein came from. Frankenstein is based on this golem story. That the rabbi made a golem. He made a kind of android, human-looking being. But the Maharal of Prague was a tremendously great philosopher, Jewish philosopher. He wrote about 60 books on Jewish philosophy. Big genius. Maybe. But it's all based. It's based on this idea of making something, androids. But there's a three-pronged approach which he talks about, is the Magen David, he said, symbolizes inward, outward, and upward. Inward is our own relationship with ourselves. People don't realize that we have a relationship with ourselves, right? And we have to have a good relationship with ourselves. That's very important. The first relationship we have to work on is a relationship with ourselves. That's called self-respect. Self-esteem. It's a relationship where a person likes being with themselves. A lot of people don't like being alone with themselves. So the first thing we do when we go in the car is switch on the radio, switch on the tape, CD. Why? Because we don't like being alone with ourselves. A person's got to like being alone with ourselves. And that's the reason why Shabbat, all these things, we don't do. We try and keep away from all the external kinds of amusements, and we try and get to ourselves, try and go inwards. Right? So that's inwards. And then that includes our families. And then we have upwards, which is our relationship with God. And then we have outward, which is our relationship with the rest of society. So inward is inside our houses, with ourselves, with our families. Upward is our relationship with our Creator, which is what prayer is all about. Prayer is developing a relationship with one's Creator. We talk to God in our prayers. You can say whatever you want. You can pray whatever you want. You don't have to go by the prayer book. Prayer book is a general format. If you want to add things, you can add. You can add as much as you want. So there's a idea of developing a relationship with Hashem. And the third relationship is the relationship with society. There's three different things. Inward, upward, outward. So why are there two triangles? So he says one triangle is the relationships of the individual. And the second triangle is relationships with society's relationships with other societies. Because we as Jews are trying to create a society, a Jewish society. Right? You go to Israel, that's a Jewish society. The Jewish society has to have a relationship with other societies as well. So the Jewish society has got to look inwards, as we as a totality as Jews, we have to look inwards. We have to try and see how we get along amongst ourselves. And then we've got to have develop a relationship to God based on a communal relationship, which is like a minyan. You have a communal relationship with God. It's the 10 men get together and have a communal relationship with God. And then we've got to worry about the rest of the world. Israel versus the rest of the world. It's not such a good relationship right now. But if we work on our relationship, our relationship with others will improve as well. Right? It's very important. We see this today in Israel, that there's a real split in society. They want to move from Gaza, and those who don't want to move to Gaza, they're threatening each other. It's a terrible situation. So that we have to work on ourselves, inwards, and then look upwards, develop our relationship with God, which is not so great either, and then we've got to develop our relationship with others. So three functions of relationships. We're talking about relationships. We're talking about three aspects to our relationships. Our relationships with ourselves, relationships with God, and relationships with others. Three kinds of relationships. So let's examine and let's go through the book of Bereshit. We talk about these three different kinds of relationships. Let's examine the first relationship, which is the relationship of Adam and Eve. And what do we see about Adam and Eve? Well, it's interesting about the story of Adam and Eve. I don't know if you realize, but there's one word missing, one very important word missing from the whole story, and that is the word love. Nowhere does it say that Adam loved his wife. And nowhere does it say his wife loved him. In fact, who was the first one who loved his wife?
Oh.
Yeah, Yitzhak. It says Yitzhak, Isaac. Interesting, Isaac. Isaac, it says, he took his wife into his mother's tent and he loved her. It says explicitly he loved her.
He knew.
He knew, but he didn't love her.
Yeah,
they're intimate, but it doesn't mean they love. There's no love. There's intimacy without love. That's the danger. The danger is intimacy without love is very dangerous. And we have to define what love is. That's a whole different topic. Okay, what is love? Anyone over here love apples? Yes? What do you do with them?
Eat them.
Is that how you show your love? So the answer is, love today is misused. It's a misnomer. Right? The Hollywood kind of love is when a man tells a woman, he says, I love you. What does that mean? He says, I want you and I love myself. I desire you. Love today is desire. I love the apple. I desire apples. That's not what love is. Love is,
I want you, but
I love myself and I want you. I want to satisfy my own desires. That's what it means. I love you. What do you mean I love you? I want to satisfy my desires. So that's very important. How to interpret the word love is very important. In Judaism, the word love is ahava. Ahava, it's also a brand of cosmetics, right? The Ahava brand of cosmetics from the Dead Sea. It's a new brand of cosmetics. New company, started in 1991. Ahava brand. Ahava is based on the word hav. Hav means to give. Love is based on giving. It's not taking. Today's love is taking. I love apples. I want to take them. I love this woman. I want to take her for myself. Satisfy myself. Hav means giving. That's why love starts with children. Someone who you always give to. A little baby you're always giving. There's no other, you don't get anything from the baby. That's right. Very good. You get something back when you give. People don't realize that. People think you're just giving, you're not really getting. The truth is you're getting as well. You should be getting some satisfaction, which applies to children. When you give them, you get a smile in return. You get some sort of satisfaction. And in fact, the best kind of feeling is by giving. You know, in classes for fundraising, which rabbis sometimes have to go to, they teach you when you want a donation, a big donation, always go to someone who's given already. Don't go to someone who's never given a big donation. Go to someone who's already given a big donation. Why? Because that person already knows the satisfaction involved in giving a big donation. And therefore he's motivated to give more. Interesting. I'd have thought the opposite, you know. You think the opposite. Who do you go to? Don't go to someone who's given a lot. Go to someone who hasn't given anything. It's harder. They've never felt the feeling of giving. The feeling of getting a kick out of giving. People who have given.
You give somebody a job who already has lots of jobs as opposed to somebody who doesn't?
That's right. A busy guy, give him, he'll get the work done. Why? He knows how to get things done. Guy who's never been busy, it's a bad sign. If he's not busy, it's a bad sign. Right? So a guy who's busy, it's a good sign. Okay, let's talk about the first relation. The first relation is Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve were created on the sixth day of creation. Sixth day of creation. Why were they created last? The last thing to be created before Shabbat was Adam and Eve. So the Midrash says, if they were good, God says, you're the pinnacle of creation. Everything was created for you. If they were bad, God says, I created the ant before you. Who do you think you are? Let's keep everything in perspective. If you're great, everything was great for you. If you're not so great, everything came before you. You're last. So, Adam and Eve. And what was the relationship between Adam and Eve? And it's interesting because she was created from his rib. So Talmud asked an interesting question. Only Jews would ask this question. Why wasn't she created from his head? Or from his feet? So Talmud said an interesting idea. If she'd be created from his head, she'd be his boss. And God did not want to create a woman to be the man's boss. If she was created from his feet, he'd stamp all over her. He didn't want to create a woman to be trodden on. He created her from his ribs, so he'd hug her tight to his heart. Which is a beautiful idea. I mean, marriage is hugging each other tight. An emotional, interpersonal relationship. Very deep interpersonal relationship. So that's... But the relationship between Adam and Eve sort of failed because there was kind of miscommunication. As we find, when they eat the apple, what happens? God tells Adam, he said, how come you ate the apple? He said, the woman you gave me, she made me the apple. Right? So straight away we find there's a breakdown between the two. He's blaming his wife, she's blaming the snake, he's all untangling, everything's untangling. So what went wrong? So the rabbis say miscommunication. He tells his wife, don't eat the fruits and don't even touch the tree. God says, don't even touch the tree. He sort of made a fence around the Torah. Right? He wants her not even to touch it. And he told her, he says, when you touch it, you're going to die. So what happened? She touched it, nothing happened. So the snake said, now you can eat it, nothing happened. Just like you touch it, nothing happens. So there was a miscommunication between the two. Man and wife, most of the problems of communication. It's all communication. What sets man apart from animals? The ability to talk. Speech. Yeah, sure. She's copying out. But we see over here a breakdown of communication between the two. Between the two is a breakdown. The relationship between man and God, same thing. Relationship between man and God suffered as a consequence of what they did. So straight away we find there was no other people around. There was no society. So two out of three relationships already failed. Right? The rabbi said this was day one. The same day they were created, within the first 2 hours of creation, they only had one commandment, one mitzvah. They broke the same. Same day. Everything happened the same day. Then they have children. What happens to their children? What happens to their children? Cain and Abel. One's a murderer and one's a murdered. Imagine having two children. One's a murderer, one's a murderer. A terrible thing. Terrible calamity. So straight away we find relationships are breaking up. What's the problem with Cain and Abel? See, here the Midrash gives us a couple of options.
Jealousy.
Exactly, jealousy. Jealousy about what?
About the offering to Hashem, one's acceptable.
Okay, so the Midrash goes even deeper. The Midrash says one stage removed. It says Cain was a farmer, right? He was a farmer, tilled the soil. And he claimed all the land belonged to him. Abel busied himself with movable objects. He worked with sheep, as the Torah tells us. Sheep are movable objects. He claimed everything in the world belonged to him. The land belonged to him, and everything in the world belonged to him. All the movable objects belonged to him. And he's making clothes, and he's growing crops. So Cain told Abel, if you want everything movable, get off my land. And Abel said, if you want everything movable, take off your clothes. So they had a fight. Who owns what? You know, a big fight. That's jealousy. Jealousy. It's all jealousy. Everything centered around jealousy. The Midrash says also they were arguing about wives. Apparently, Abel had two wives and Cain only had one. Don't ask me where the women came from. But that's So argue about wives, argue about this. What the Torah, what the Midrash is telling us, it's all about jealousy. The Torah seems to say it was more spiritual kind of jealousy. Don't think jealousy only exists in the physical realm. The Torah also seems to tell us that there's spiritual jealousy as well. What happened? They both brought offerings, and Abel's offering was accepted by God, and Cain's offering was not accepted by God. So again, we see relationships over here falling apart, and the Mishnah tells us there are three things that destroy a person. What are the three things that destroy a person?
Jealousy.
Greed. Desire, it says. Desire.
Pride.
And pride. And pride. Jealousy, greed, and pride. Three things that can destroy a person, which are the three things that destroy relationships. Jealousy, greed, desire, and pride. Three things can destroy relationships. You find people today, they argue. And no one wants to be the first to make the mend the fence. Why? It's pride, right? No one wants to be the first to say sorry. Someone has to say sorry. They both have to say sorry. But someone has got to take that step and say sorry first. And no one wants to say sorry first. Sometimes you got to say sorry even if you're not sorry. Sometimes you got to say sorry even when you're not wrong. Why? You just, someone's got to do it. The other person's too big or full of pride. So you be the first one. It's very hard to do, by the way. It's very hard to do, especially when we feel that you're right. But that's a bigger person, is the person who can break their pride and go ahead and do it. Just jump it. Number three, the flood generation. The flood. Have you heard of the flood? Noach. Right, everyone heard. Everyone, little kids heard about Noach, right? Noach. Noach and the ark. Noach and the ark. Why is there a flood in the world? Why did God destroy the world? So the Torah tells us. Torah says a few things. A few reasons. Let's see what the Torah says. I don't, I'm not making this up. This is all from the text. I'll just read it from the text. God saw that man was doing evil in the land. And all his inclination was all evil all day. Okay? Men were doing evil. What evil were they doing? So in Parsha Noach, in the second parasha, which is on chapter 6 of the Torah, it says, the earth is corrupted, all flesh is corrupted, its way about the earth. Right? What does that mean? That means immorality. Immorality means abuse of relationships. Instead of cultivating strong, productive relationships, people are just abusing each other. And that's immorality. And number two is, the earth has been full of robbery. We find society was a society which is corrupt. Right? So we said there's three aspects to relationships. One is one's own relationship with oneself. Relationship within one's house. Relationship with God and relationship in society. Society over here is crumbling. And furthermore, the idolatry, which the Torah doesn't mention, obviously is full of idolatry as well. So the two out of three, and there was no family life, so three out of three failed. When three out of three fail, that's it, that's the end of the earth. When three out of three relationships fail, that's the end of society. From there we go to the Tower of Babel. What happened to the Tower of Babel? The word Babel in English comes from Babel, the Tower of Babel. Where it says God what did he do to the languages? He split them. He scrambled them up. Very good. He scrambled up all the languages. Before there was only one language, it says. That's what the Torah says. Which we say was Hebrew. Lashon HaKodesh, it says, was the oldest language, according to our tradition. And what happened? The Torah tells us in chapter 10. God says they are one nation with one language. And this is what they started to do. Right? He doesn't say what they started to do. It's not so clear what they did. They did something. Well, there's different explanations over here. We'll try and cover some bases over here. But God says they speak one language and they're one united nation. Right? So let's try and see the positive first. Number one is they're all on the same page. They're united. Right? That's fantastic. To be united is fantastic. They speak the same language. That's great, right? Today, the whole world, they're all speaking different languages. You know, we try and make English the universal language. The French are mad. They want French to be the universal language. The Spanish, they want Spanish to be the universal language. So anyway, so at that time, they're speaking one universal language. Imagine the whole world speaking one universal language. The whole world is united. Is that good or bad? It's great.
Depends on how you use it,
It's great, but it depends on how you use it. Exactly. Unity is a tool, right? It can be a tool for good, it can be a tool for bad. Germany was united under the Nazis. Doesn't mean it's great. It wasn't very good. So it's a tool. Unity is a tool like any other tool. Like science is a tool. Everything's a tool. And it depends on what it's used for. So there's a different ways of describing it. The Torah describes it. It says the whole world was one language and the varim achadim, and one purpose or one speech. Right? So what's the difference between one language and one speech? So here the commentaries tell us it was totalitarian society. You could only speak one speech, which means you had to toe the party line. Right? Imagine, dictatorship. It was dictatorship. You couldn't think for yourself. Exactly. Right? So what happened over here? Society broke down. When they were the most united, how did they break down? Totalitarianism. Dictatorship. Okay? Dictatorship is also a breakdown of society. It looks great on the outside, but the truth is, you're not allowed to think for yourself. Right? So God says, you know what I'm going to do? These guys are misusing the unity by communism. You're under a dictatorship, you can't think for yourself. God says, you know what, I want people to think for themselves. What am I going to do? I'm going to make them all speak differently. Okay? That's a great way to make people think for themselves, right? I can't speak to you. You can't tell me what to do. I can't understand what you're saying. There's an interesting midrash. The midrash says, when a person, they were building this tower, this massive tower to go up to heaven. Rashi says they wanted to attack God. They thought in their narrow minds, God is in heaven, we can attack him. Let's go up to heaven and kill God. Imagine, think of such a thought. That's one of the relationships. One of the three relationships is our relationship with God. They wanted to break the relationship with God. They also calculated that it's time for another flood. We don't want God to flood the earth. Let's build supports for the heavens. This way there's, you know, the heavens collapse, we're going to support the heavens like Atlas. You know, this whole idea of Atlas holding up the heavens, it's based over here on this concept. They built a tower to support the heavens. Because what happens when it rains? The heavens break. It crack and the rains come through. That's the idea over there. So let's support the heavens by building this big tower. So different ideas over here. But in the building of the tower, the Midrash says, think of this. When a man fell down, no one cried. When a brick fell down, everybody cried. What does that tell us about society? A utilitarian society. Utilitarian society means we care more about bricks than we care about human beings. And that was Nazism. Nazism was caring more about society than caring about the individual. Caring about the good of society, which means the physical good, welfare, material welfare. You know, in some textbooks, in Nazi textbooks, they put a picture of how many young people are supporting an old person. Right? In other words, we are supporting the elderly with our earning. We're earning money to support the elderly. That's a big problem today in America about social welfare, right? Social security. Who's going to support all these old timers? All the, what they call, which generation? Huh? Baby boomers. The baby boomers. They're all getting old. Who's going to support them? Can you imagine putting that in a textbook in school? How many young people does it take to support an old person? One old person. And then showing a picture of young people carrying old people on the back. So what sense is it drummed into young children? Hey, they're just a burden. What are they doing for us? Nothing. And they're just a burden to society. That's a utilitarian approach. So here in this building, this tower, all they cared about was their bricks. People died? No problem. The bricks died. The bricks broke. Oh, they all started crying. Utilitarianism. So there's a lot of different lessons over here to learn in terms of construction of society. Constructing a society is not just enough. Unity is not enough. We have to be able to have free thought, free expression. Right? There has to be free expression. On the other hand, unity is important. So there's a dialectic all the time. In America today, there's a big dialectic. How much free expression? Can you burn the flag? Right, there was a big court case. It went to the Supreme Court. What was the answer? Yes. Yes, you can burn the American flag. Imagine. First Amendment rights. Freedom of speech is so important. And yet, there's a boundary. Hate. There's hate. Libel. Hate. You can't talk as much as you want. It's hate. Hate crimes. So a person expresses hate, they can be sued. In Canada, even freer. You can say as much hate as you want. That's why Nazis go to Canada and they can spread their garbage from Canada. In America, we're much more stricter, and I hate. So that's interesting.
You can't color fire in a private theater.
You can't?
You can't. You can create create a panic. People will get killed.
That's right. It's not a free country. So there's a dialectic.
Here too.
There's limits to the freedom.
Right. There's limits to the freedom. Of course. There has to be. So why? Because you have unity on the one side pulling against freedom. So in the case of the Tower of Babel, the rabbis tell us they were all pro-unity and no expression of freedom. It was one language twice, which means they spoke one language and they all had to tell the party line. They couldn't say what they wanted to say. They had to speak the same speech, same ideas. No one's allowed freedom of expression. So we see the dialectic in building societies in terms of having positive relationships in societies. Then we continue with the story of Abraham, which comes to this week's Torah portion. Now it's interesting because Abraham, his wife's name was Sarah, right? Which means princess. The first Jewish American princess. Jewish princess. First Jewish princess. Sarah, that was her name, princess. First it was Sarai, which means my princess. That's what he called her, my princess. And then it became Sarah, princess of the world. She was elevated. First he was Avram, the big father. And then he became Avraham, father of many nations. God changed the name. So it's interesting, he addressed his wife as my princess. What a beautiful name to call his wife, right? Sarai, my princess. And then what happens? Sarai cannot have children. Right? She couldn't have children. And she tells Abraham, the first case of surrogate motherhood. It's interesting. First case of surrogate motherhood is right here, right at the beginning of Genesis. Interesting, isn't it interesting? And just find it. On chapter 16. Chapter 16 of Genesis. First case, surrogate motherhood. Sarah cannot have children. She tells Abraham, have my maid. Have my maid. My maid will give birth. And it will be as if it's my child. Right, before baby M, right? Way before baby M case. First case, surrogate motherhood, is in the Torah. Everything's in the Torah. So someone said, bring the Torah up to date. Here we have it. We talked about communism. We talked about surrogate motherhood. It's all here. Everything's in here. Different names, different situations, different societies, but human nature has not changed. Everything's the same. And what happens? The surrogate mother, Hagar, now feels more important. I just had a baby. My husband's first wife can't have children. She's a nobody. She can't have children. I'm providing for the future. I'm bringing a name for him in the world. And therefore it says, when Hagar saw that she had conceived, her mistress was lowered in her esteem. So Sarah says to Abraham, the outrage against me is due to you. I gave you my maidservant, and when she saw she had conceived, I became lowered in her esteem. Let Hashem judge between me and you. She said, may God judge between me and you. So we find this interesting situation. Now we have a three-way street. That's why rabbis say today, no two wives. You can't marry two wives in Jewish law. It's a very old law going back over 1,000 years. Rabbeinu Gershom made the law. So over 1,000 years, Jews have not been allowed to marry more than one wife. Because we see right from the beginning of time that it never turns out well. There's always, in fact, in Jewish law, it's interesting, when the Mishnah talks about two wives, it calls them a tzara. The second wife is called a tzara, which means a trouble. The second wife is a trouble. She's trouble to the first wife, and that will cause friction in the family, with husband as well is going to get in problems as well. And that's what you see right here. So Abraham says, you know what? You do whatever you want. You're in charge. You're in control. You do whatever you want. You want to kick her out? Kick her out. I've given up. I'm not going to get involved in this. You offered it to me. She got pregnant. Now you have second thoughts. Do whatever you want. So it says, Sarah takes her and throws her out of the house. Imagine she's pregnant, thrown out of the house. And Abraham just goes along. And she runs away. And then the angel appears to her and says, go back. And you're going to have a son called Ishmael. Right? Ishmael. The Ishmaelites. Who are the Ishmaelites today? The Arabs, they claim to be descendants of Ishmael. The Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, is a famous rabbi in Spain, who had a disputation with Pablo Cristiani. It's a good book you can get hold of called The Disputation in the 12th century. And it's now printed in English. he says, he writes in his commentary on the Torah, he says over here, he says, all our problems with the Muslims, it's nothing new, we've had problems with Muslims many years, he says, go back to this situation, where Sarah afflicted her maid, and because of that she had a son called Ishmael. And all the afflictions we get from Ishmael are due to how she handled her maid. Interpersonal relationships. How do you handle your maid? You know, there's a famous story. It says the Chafetz Chaim, who's a very famous rabbi in Poland in the 1930s, says he was invited to someone's house for Shabbat. Right? So, usually it takes a long time. Makes kiddush, and he eats, and this and that. All of a sudden over here, he's very fast. He made a kiddush, and he had his meal. He finished in record time, says grace after meal, it's finished, gone. Within half an hour, everything's over. He said, what happened, Rabbi? What happened tonight? Why in a rush? He said, you see that poor woman who's slaving in the kitchen, the cook? She's a widow, and she has children, and she wants to get back to her children. She has to make kiddush for her children. Oh, they're all waiting for her. We have to have compassion on our servants. People don't realize that. We have to have compassion on our servants. People don't realize how much compassion we have to have. A person has a housemaid, or a cleaner, whatever it is, have compassion. Think about things. So, you know, some people, they say, you have a cleaner coming in, so therefore, you know what, let's make a big mess. They're coming in anyway, we're paying them anyway. Let's make a bigger mess. Have compassion. Even though they're working for you, have compassion. That's what the Torah is telling us over here. She never had compassion on a maid. The maid is pregnant now. You got her pregnant, you gave it to your husband. Now what are you going to do? You going to throw out the house? That's not the way to be. So Ramban says, all our troubles today come from this episode. Interesting. That's the first situation we have. Of relationships. The other relationship is Sarah had a brother. What's her brother's name? His name was Lot. L-O-T. Lot. Right? And he figures over here in this story as well. And Abraham, apparently Abraham's brother Haran died. And Abraham and Haran had two children. Sarah and Lot. So what does Abraham do? In those days it was very common to marry a niece. In fact, the Talmud advocates marrying in the family. Why? It says there's less friction. There's less in-laws. You marry a relative, there's less in-laws, right? You marry a niece, it's even better. Why? Because you know who your in-laws are, your brother and sister. One of the two. So in Jewish law, it's allowed to marry a niece. Today, we frown on it. Not because it's forbidden in Jewish law, but because it's bad for the gene pool. Today we know about genetic diseases. It's interesting. The rabbis talked about this 1,000 years ago. Rabbi Yehuda Hasid, who was a German rabbi, Rabbi Judah, the righteous, the pious, he wrote a book, Sefer Hasidim, and he says over there, man should not marry his close relatives, even though they're allowed. It's even to say cousins should not marry. They're allowed to. They come to the rabbi and say, want to get married? Okay. It's not advisable because of the gene pool. It's too close. But is it allowed? It's allowed. Can a man marry his niece? Yes. He can't marry his aunt, which is interesting, because then he's uncovering the nakedness of his father. But he can marry his niece. So that's an interesting idea.
But isn't he covering his sister from marrying his niece?
His niece can be from his brother or his sister. But it's one step removed. Right? It's further removed.
Is that another predicate?
No, it's nothing to do with women.
What?
It's nothing to do with women. Because he can marry his niece, and her niece can marry an uncle. Why? Look at it the other way. You can marry your uncle. It's not prejudice against you. You can marry your uncle if you want. Right.
What
tough. So it's interesting. That's an interesting law. Not all these laws have rational reasons. But it could be there's more genetics in terms of the gene pool, marrying one's niece as opposed to marrying one's less genetics involved. As I find out. If you can look it up, do some research. Is there a difference from a genetic point of view of marrying one's niece and marrying one's aunt? Would there be a difference? Okay. So what happened? He adopts his brother's daughter, and he married her. And he adopted his brother's son as his son. He never had children. So Lot becomes, in effect, Abraham's inheritor. He's going to inherit Abraham. Right? And what happens? It's interesting. The two people that Abraham fails with, Abraham's trying to change the world, right? He's trying to spread. What is he trying to spread? Ethical monotheism. Abraham is trying to spread ethical monotheism, which means belief in one God and ethics. In other words, we believe in a God who's ethical. We believe in a God who wants justice and righteousness. Interesting. That's very important. So therefore, Abraham's spreading in this world this idea that there's one God who wants us to be good. That was Abraham's radical That was a new thing about Abraham, right? He was the first one to spread it to others. Noach may have known about God, may have known that God is good, but he never tried to spread it. Shem, his son of Noach, also knew about God, but never tried to spread it. Adam knew about God, but never tried to spread it. Abraham was the first one who's trying to spread ethical monotheism. And the Bible tells us he was very successful. How do we know? Because it says, and he came with the souls he had made in Haran. Souls he had made. How do you make souls? He had converted people. He had brought people in. He was a missionary. Abraham was the first missionary. To what? To bring people close to God. Which kind of God? Ethical monotheism. It's very important to realize that. Abraham was the founder of ethical monotheism and spread the word of ethical monotheism in the world. So all the great religions today come from Abraham. He was on the front cover of National Geographic, right? About 6 months ago. Abraham, father of three great religions. Now, Judaism is not a great religion in terms of numbers. It's interesting. Here's Islam, 1 billion people. Christianity, over 1 billion people. And here they put three great religions. How many people do we have? 12 million. If we're lucky, 12 million. So three great religions, we're great. It's interesting. The Torah says, I'm going to make you a great nation, but not great in numbers, great in value. It's interesting. Our greatness is not measured in numbers. With however few we are, 30% of Nobel Prize have been won by Jews. 0.01, less than 0.01% of the Jewish population, of the population of the world. So it's amazing. It's not numbers. It's not a numbers game. It's quality, not quantity. It's unbelievable.
It's negative quality. Yeah. The world hates such a
That's
small
right.
group of people.
Such a small group of people. For what? 12 million people. You tell an anti-Semite, how many Jews are in the world? It's telling them billions. So we tell them there's only 12 million. They say, well, they all must live in my vicinity. And there's anti-Semitism in a place where there's no Jews, in Japan. The Japanese are very anti-Semitic. And one of the best popular books over there is Protocols of the Elders of Zion. They really believe the Jews have a plan to take over the world. Why? Because who's running America? They look at the guy on top. Who's the guy in the bank of Federal Bank? Federal Reserve? Alan Greenspan. Here he is. Makes the policy. He sets the policy. Everyone looks at him and says, oh, the Jews are running America. So it's a terrible thing. But here we are, a tiny population. Tiny, tiny, tiny. 12 million people in the whole world. 1 billion Muslims. 1 billion Christians. One of the three great religions. Abraham gave birth to. So Abraham, it says, trying to spread ethical monotheism, who does he fail with? His own nephew, Lot. The one who he wants to be his son. He adopted him as his son. Lot leaves him and goes to Sodom. Can you imagine what a slap in the face this is? You know, Abraham, you're preaching ethical monotheism. To heck with your ethics. I'm going to Sodom. You know what they do in Sodom? That's where the word sodomy came from. So here he is. Abraham's preaching, good. Runs to the other extreme. What a slap in the face that was for Abraham. Wow. Failure. Then he has this son from Hagar, Ishmael. What happens to Ishmael? Ishmael rebels against him. And he has to throw him out of the house. Imagine, he's preaching to the whole world. With his own relatives, it's the hardest thing to do, by the way. To preach to your own relatives, forget it. No one wants to hear. You can preach to everyone else, you can't preach to your own relatives. You can't change, the hardest people to change are people in your own house. And those are the people that know you the best. That's interesting. There's a famous story, it says, of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, it says, everyone knew him as a great rabbi. The further away from his home, he says, the more they talked about the chief rabbi, the chief rabbi, the chief rabbi. The closer he came home, they said rabbi. When he went into his house, his wife said, Yisrael, take out the garbage. So it says, people know you the most, you know, they have less regard for you. It's much harder, it says, to be a rabbi in your own community where you grew up. You say, that kid, that schnip, I saw him growing up. Who is he to come and preach to me? I saw him in diapers. What's he coming to preach to me now? It's always better to go be a rabbi in a different community, not in your own community where you grew up. So here's Abraham failing with the two people who he really spent the most time with. People he's talking to, Lot and Ishmael, the son he gave birth to. So it's a terrible tragedy. And then we have the relationship between Isaac and the Philistines. It talks about society and Abraham and the Philistines. Basically, every time they went there, their wives were kidnapped. Think about this. I mean, I had a discussion with someone whether society's improved or not. Right? Has society today, is society today an improvement of society 300 years ago? Yes or no?
In terms of what?
In terms of progress, civilization. Are we more civilized, not just in technology, or are we more civilized even in treating each other? Huh? Yes, are we better or not?
To some degree, yeah.
I think we have to say yes.
Yes, I agree with you. How do I know? Read the stories of what happened in those days. Abraham crosses the border into Egypt. You know what they do? They kidnap his wife. They tell Pharaoh, there's a beautiful woman here. You should take her for your heart. He goes into Philistine country. The first thing they do is they kidnap his wife. By the way, you got to watch out when you go to Morocco. This happens today in Arab countries. I know a guy lost his wife in Morocco. Kidnapped her. She probably ended up someone's harem in Saudi Arabia. Who knows? So the BBC wanted to make a documentary about Saudi Arabia, about the kings of Saudi Arabia. And the government of Saudi Arabia put pressure on the British government. And they pulled the strings. They pulled it. They pulled that documentary. It was never made. If it's a documentary about Israel, no problem. Documentary about Saudi Arabia, it never gets made. They're so scared of Saudi Arabia. You know, the oil weapon. They're so scared of it. So it's terrible. But that's where you go then. They're full of, the harems are just full over there. Hundreds of women over there. Where from? All over the world.
Society here, a woman is safe. Mm. In other words, I can't just strike a woman simply because she's
right.
Female.
There's laws that protect her.
Okay,
but there are laws that protect her.
Yes, of course. But it reflects the image of society. You look across into the Middle East and you see a complete reverse.
That's right. And that's how the whole world was like. We have to remember that. That's how the whole world was. Society, in a sense, has come to this conclusion that we're all equal. All human beings are equal under God. That's the United Nations Charter. That's the Constitution of the United States. But that's the idea. They're setting up all sorts of committees, you know, worrying about the children, worrying about the women. That's a great advance. That's a tremendous advance. So how do we know this? Look at the stories. Look at the stories of what happened over here and see how society has advanced tremendously. So that's how their relationship with other societies. They go everywhere they go. Their wives are kidnapped. See what kind of societies were in those days. Then we come to interpersonal relationships within the family. Okay, so we talked about Sarah and Hagar. And then it gets more personal. Isaac and Rebecca, Rivka and Yitzchak, they have children. Who do they have? Twins. Who?
Jacob
and Esau. They're twins. And these two twins are totally dissimilar. That's interesting. Imagine, the Torah is telling us they had twins. So what do you think? Twins, okay. They're from the same womb at the same time. They come out. And you know what's happening in the womb? The Torah is telling us they're fighting in the womb. They're fighting. What are they fighting about? Who's going to come out first? It's very strange. Who's going to inherit what? There's jealousy from within. It seems to be inborn. See, it's genetic. It's kind of all of us. We've got it inside us. The jealousy is inborn. And the closer we are, you see sibling rivalry. The Torah starts talking about sibling rivalry. Well, the first sibling rivalry was Cain and Abel. Cain kills Abel. Here we have sibling rivalry on a lesser level. You see, slowly society is improving. First sibling rivalry ended in murder. The second sibling rivalry nearly ends in murder. One of them has to run away. Right? Then we have sibling rivalry between Joseph and his brothers, which also nearly ends in murder. And one of them has to be sent away or sold as a slave far away. So you have sibling rivalry. Now the Torah focuses on relationships within the family of siblings. You know, brothers should love each other, right? That's the biggest joke. Brothers should love each other. But sibling rivalry is well and alive. Today we're having less children. So where there's one child in the family, there's no sibling rivalry. That solves that problem. You have other problems now. Who's he going to play with? He's always bored. I want someone to play with. Truth is, there should be no sibling rivalry. And that's what we're going to talk about. That's how the beginning of Exodus starts off. You know, it's interesting. What caused the Jews to go to Egypt? You know what caused the Jews to be going to Egypt? They sold their brother into Egypt as a slave. And what happened? They all became slaves in Egypt. God says, you sell your brother as a slave, you're all going to become slaves.
I thought it was famine that drove them all to Egypt.
And he sent them to buy food from Egypt. And then, who did they meet in Egypt? The brother they sold there. And he says, you know what, guys? Come over here. I'm the king now. You can come over here. I'll look after you. So in a sense, he brought them. The one they had sold brought them back into Egypt. And that's how the slavery started. Because if they wouldn't have sold them to Egypt, they would never have ended up in Egypt. They would have no ties to Egypt. They would have gone, bought food, and come back. That's what Jacob told them to do. But they get stuck in Egypt because he's there. How did he get there? They sold him there. So slavery in Egypt starts because of hatred of brothers. Interesting. What ends it? What causes it to end? Love of siblings. Where do we see this? It says Miriam and Moses and Aaron loved each other. How do we know? It says God tells Moses, he says, go and redeem your brethren. How long did God talk to Moses at the burning bush? Any ideas? Moses keeps arguing. Not me, not me. Send someone else, send someone else, someone else. 7 days. 7 days is arguing with God. I mean, I wouldn't argue with God for more than 1 second. Wouldn't argue with God probably. You know, God says, do this. Okay, how high? But Moses, 7 days is arguing. Until at the end, God tells Moses. He says, I know your brother Aaron will come and be happy that you're the leader. And then Moses says, okay. So we see, why is he arguing for 7 days? He says he was worried. Aaron is his older brother. It's not honor for him that I take the leadership when I'm the younger brother. He should be the leader, not me. When God tells him, don't worry, Aaron, your brother, will be happy. He says, okay, if he's going to be happy, he's going to accept this. He's going to be happy. I'm going to accept this one.
Didn't Aaron speak for Moses?
Yeah. And he said, he'll be your speaker. He wasn't happy with that. He says, he should be the leader, not me. Why is he taking orders from me? Why is my older brother taking orders from me? Now, how many younger brothers are worried about their brother's, older brother's honor today? It just doesn't happen. You don't see it. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. You know, it's interesting. In Jewish law, you've got to stand up for your older brother. You've got to give respect. Today, we don't give respect to anyone. You've got to show respect to your parents. There's a beautiful story. It's a great story. It's a true story. In Israel, there was a comedian. His name was Uri Zohar. Very famous Israeli comedian. He was an actor and a comedian. And then he became religious. But he was, you know, sort of starting off becoming religious. And they were working on him. They said, you know, send your kid to yeshiva. Instead of sending him to secular school, send him to kid to yeshiva. So he says, okay, I'll try it out. Sends his kid to yeshiva. A week later, he walks into his kitchen and the kid's having a meal. You know what the kid does? Stands up for him. He said, what? He walks out again. Maybe it's an accident. Coincidence. Walks back in, the kid stood up. Can't be. Walks out again and walks back in. The kid stood up. He said, why are you standing up? He said, Abba, he said, Ani noten lecha kavod. He says, Daddy, he said, I'm giving you honor. So what? You're giving me honor. He said, it's worth it. Yeshiva tuition is worth it. Just to come home and your kids give you honor. Where do you get that today? You get honor from kids. Where your kids come to you and say, Daddy, can I bring you a glass of water? Would you like something? Need anything? You know, so there's another joke. It says, it's a true story also. So there's two men on a plane. There's a rabbi sitting next to one of the people in the Knesset who's secular, totally secular Jew from the Knesset, on El Al, coming back to Israel. And the secular kid is saying, Dad, can I have this and can I have that? And the rabbi's son is saying, Dad, can I get you this, can I get you that? So the member of the Knesset asks the rabbi, he says, tell me, he says, how come your son honoring you and asks you if he can help you, whereas my son always wants things from me? He said, "It's look, what do you teach your child? You teach him Darwin's theory, right? We're all descended from apes. If we're all descended from apes, then the next generation is always better than the previous generation. Why? Because the previous generation is less evolved than the next generation. The younger generation is always a higher level. It's evolved more, further away from the ape. Right? We teach our children that we come from God. And Adam was made in the highest in the image of God. Each of us is going downwards in a sense. So therefore they have to respect the previous generation. But that's the idea. The idea is respect in families. And we have to respect our elders. We have to respect our older brothers. You know, the hatred of Joseph started. Why did the hatred of Joseph start? Who was jealous of who?
He was jealous of Joseph with the
That's the next stage. What's the first stage in the story? It's interesting because a lot of people don't realize that. Yeah, what does he do? He tells tales, right? It says explicitly in the Torah.
You have to look at the whole family, though. It seems to be dysfunctional.
Yes, you're right. That's right. That's what the whole of Genesis is all about. The whole of Bereishit, that's what I'm saying. The whole of Bereishit is about relationships which have gone sour.
Right. I never realized that the first two, Abraham and Yitzhak, also their families is a dysfunctional thing.
That's right. There's something going on over here, but it's not in just in their families. The Torah is just zeroing on these two, on these three families. But you know what? If it happened to them, it's a microcosm of the greater society. That's right, exactly.
But it's interesting that all three families are dysfunctional.
Exactly, exactly. The first family was dysfunctional because of his two wives. Abraham brought another wife in. Before that, there was no problems.
The Almighty tells Abraham, listen to your wife. He throws out his firstborn son, and he gives his wife just about nothing. You know, a bottle of water. And
that's right.
What's going on here? It's something I have to look at more deeply. The second one also, now we have Yitzhak ready to kill his son.
No, the other way around. Abraham was ready to kill the Both situations.
Yeah.
One son he sent away, the other son he's going to kill. What's going on over here?
Very strange.
So the answer the rabbis give is, there's a test. This is all a test for Abraham. What was Abraham's trait? Kindness. He was naturally good, naturally kind. A lot of people are naturally kind. I had an aunt. She was a total giver. Always giving, 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 giving. The hardest test for a person like that is disciplining. Send your child away disciplined. You know, I heard a story today. Another rabbi, I listened to other rabbis' tapes as well. So he was saying a story. He said, he heard from one of his congregants, he said, my father did the best favor for me. He said, when? He says, I was involved in a motorbike accident because I was drunk. And I was in jail. The cops arrested me. They put me in the cell. I called up my father 2 a.m. in the morning. And I said, Dad, help! I'm in jail! He says, where are you? He said, I'm in jail. He said, okay, stay there. Put the phone down. He said, first he said, I hated my dad. And then he said, I thank my dad for that every day. Because he taught me responsibility. So in a sense, the test of Abraham was, can you be tough when it warrants to be tough? Sometimes you got to be tough. You got to have discipline. Other times, you know, easygoing, he's a giver, he's a kind person. The test is, can the kind person also be tough when he needs to be tough? That's also the test. Yeah. A tough love, right? That's what we need some today. We're failing as parents in terms of...
Isaac's a very strange character.
Very strange.
Because everything happens to him and he doesn't do anything.
Very good.
I mean, it's like his father
Excellent.
And his brother.
He's acting on.
And then in the middle,
why? So the rabbis say, you know what? He had the trait of gevura. Gevura is might. The Mishnah says, what is a mighty person? A person who controls his desires, who can control himself completely. Isaac was in total self-control. He didn't react.
If I'm interpreting this correctly, Isaac's an adult when Abraham...
37 years old.
Yeah, so you know, you sit with a 37-year-old, you come here, I'm going to such a...
Yeah, kid. That's right.
Because, you know, he's following up on. So everything happens to him. You know, in...
But that's the trait of self-control. He was totally in self-control. He controlled himself entirely. You can do whatever you want. Self-control. I'm not going to react. I'm going to control my reactions. His son tricks him. What does the father do? Son's screaming and shouting, how come you're so-and-so? How can you trick me? He says, you know what? Self-control. I'm not going to lose my temper. You know, there's a story about Hillel, famous rabbi. He says, two people had a bet where they can make Hillel lose his temper or not. So one guy took the bet. He says, okay, I'm going to make Hillel lose his temper. He comes to him on a Friday night before Shabbat. Hillel's taking a shower. He bangs on the door. He says, Hillel! Hillel! Hillel comes out in his bathrobe. He says, Hillel, ask some stupid question. He says, oh, my son, what a good question. Good answer. Comes back 5 minutes later. Hillel! Guy comes out in his bathrobe. Yes, my son, what can I do for you? Happened 10 times. And Hillel never lost his temper. So he says, Hillel, he lost his temper. Hillel, I hope there are no more rabbis like you in Israel. He says, why? Why? He says, because you made me lose money. You made me lose 400 gold coins on my wager. He said, it's better you lose your money than I lose my temper. So Isaac was a guy to control his instincts completely. Your father wants to slit your throat. What would you do? You'd attack. You'd do something. He says, you know what? I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to control myself. I'd rather be worked on and control myself than... Obviously, he went to the nth degree. That was the nth degree. But it worked out right. I mean, everything worked out. I mean, if he'd have cursed, imagine. He could have lost both sons. One son tricked him, right? What would he have done? If he'd have lost control, he'd have cursed him. You know, Noach, Noach loses control. He curses one of his own children. What a crazy thing to do. Imagine cursing one's own children. That's a crazy thing to do. It's the worst thing a person can do. That's a person who loses control. So Yitzhak, you know what? Never lost control. Always in control of the situation.
What resists persists. Yitzhak didn't resist and the thing went away.
That's right. Exactly the point. The point is, you know what? I'm not going to control. God's in control. I'm going to withdraw my control and rely on Hashem's control. Sometimes that's the best remedy. Obviously, he's on a high level. He can believe. He believes in God's destiny and adjusting the situation. And things adjust. Okay, so let's recap. The whole of the first book of Bereshit is all about relationships. And there are three major relationships which we have to work on. On our inward relationship with ourselves and with our families. On the upward relationship with God. On the outward relationship with other people. And as a Jewish society, we also have a mission. Society is ourselves. We have to build our own perfect society. And then we have to interact with God as a society, as a community. And then we have to interact with others as a community, as a society. So there's three relationships which we have as an individual, as a society. And what is the key to positive relationships? Is Derech Eretz. Derech Eretz means manners. Literally means manners. The way of the world means manners. Civility. The key to positive relationships is civility. And my next series is going to be about this topic. About Derech Eretz. I've got about 12 talks about civility of inculcating good relationships with people through Derech Eretz. You know what Derech Eretz is? It's civility. It's a code of respect. Okay, we'll stop here. Any questions?
Yeah. The